Hello and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder and today we're going to do Chapter 2 out of The Secrets of the Federal Reserve by Eustace Mullins. It's a short chapter, probably the shortest chapter in the whole book of about 13 or 14. But it seems best to handle them one by one. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and I also post the links on pyville.net, part of the Fediverse of instances where islands of private social media can come together and cross-post, etc. Seems to be working pretty well, as I read in the middle of 2019. Anyway, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve by Eustace Mullins, Chapter 2, The Aldrich Plan. We heard in Chapter 1 about the meeting at Jekyll Island where they hatched the plot and laid out the plan for the Federal Reserve System, which is a central bank in all but name and institutional plan. It's disguised as a number of regional banks in order to not scare the people, but in fact is a central bank. Chapter 2, The Aldrich Plan. Quote, finance and the tariff are reserved by Mr. Nelson Aldrich as falling within his sole purview and jurisdiction. Mr. Aldrich is endeavoring to devise, through the National Monetary Commission, a banking and currency law. Remember, there's a panic in 1907 leading to clamor for a National Monetary Commission to set up a new monetary system for the country. Then you have the meeting at Jekyll Island in 1910. Continuing that quotation, a great many 100,000 persons are firmly of the opinion that Mr. Aldrich sums up in his personality the greatest and most sinister menace to the popular welfare of the United States. Ernest Newman recently said, what the South visits on the Negro in a political way, Aldrich would mete out to the mudsills of the North if he could devise a safe and practical way to accomplish it. Harper's Weekly, May 7, 1910. Mullins says, the participants in the Jekyll Island Conference returned to New York to direct a nationwide propaganda campaign in favor of the quote-unquote Aldrich Plan. Three of the leading universities, Princeton, Harvard, and the University of Chicago, were used as the rallying points for this propaganda, and national banks had to contribute to a fund of $5 million to persuade the American public that this central bank plan should be enacted into law by Congress. Woodrow Wilson, governor of New Jersey and former president of Princeton University, was enlisted as a spokesman for the Aldrich Plan. During the panic of 1907, Wilson had declared, all this trouble could be averted if we appointed a committee of six or seven public-spirited men like J.P. Morgan to handle the affairs of our country. In his biography of Nelson Aldrich in 1930, Stevenson suggests, or says, a pamphlet was issued January 16, 1911, suggested plan for monetary legislation by Honorable Nelson Aldrich based on Jekyll Island conclusions. Stevenson says on page 388, an organization for financial progress had been formed. Mr. Warburg introduced a resolution authorizing the establishment of the Citizens League, later the National Citizens League. Professor Laughlin of the University of Chicago was given charge of the league's propaganda. It is notable that Stevenson characterizes the work of the National Citizens League as, quote, propaganda, in line with Seligman's exposition of Warburg's work as, quote, the education of the country, and, quote, to break down prejudices. Much of the $5 million of the banker's slush fund was spent under the auspices of the National Citizens League, which was made up of college professors. The two most tireless propagandists for the Aldrich Plan were Professor O.M. Sprague of Harvard and J. Lawrence Laughlin of the University of Chicago. Congressman Charles A. Lindbergh Sr., that is, the father of the aviator, notes, quote, J. Lawrence Laughlin, chairman of the Executive Committee of the National Citizens League since its organization, has returned to his position as a professor of political economics in the University of Chicago. In June 1911, Professor Laughlin was given a year's leave from the university that he might give all of his time to the campaign of education undertaken by the League. He has worked indefatigably, and it is largely due to his efforts and his persistence that the campaign enters the final stage with flattering prospects of a successful outcome. The reader knows that the University of Chicago is an institution endowed by John D. Rockefeller with nearly $50 million. And that was Charles A. Lindbergh, Sr. In his biography of Nelson Aldrich, Stevenson reveals that the Citizens League was also a Jekyll Island product. In Chapter 24, we find that the Aldrich Plan was represented to Congress as the result of 3 years of work, study, and travel by members of the National Monetary Commission with expenditures of more than $300,000. Remember, they said last chapter they had toured around Europe, but the actual plan was set up at Jekyll Island. An asterisk there, footnote. Charles A. Lindbergh, Sr., Banking Currency and the Money Trust, 1913. Asterisk. In 1911, the Aldrich Plan became part of the official platform of the Republican Party. So the Republicans were on the side of turning control of money away from Congress, as is in the Constitution, to a monopoly of bankers. You could print it at will, get the people into debt, forced to pay off the debts from the fake money. Testifying before the Committee on Rules, December 15, 1911, after the Aldrich Plan had been introduced in Congress, Congressman Lindbergh stated, "Our financial system is a false one and a huge burden on the people. I have alleged that there is a money trust. The Aldrich Plan is a scheme plainly in the interest of the trust. Why does the money trust press so hard for the Aldrich Plan now, before the people know what the money trust has been doing?" Lindbergh continued in his speech, "The Aldrich Plan is the Wall Street Plan. It is a broad challenge to the government by the champion of the money trust. It means another panic, if necessary, to intimidate the people. Aldrich, paid by the government to represent the people, proposes a plan for the trusts instead. It was by a very clever move that the National Monetary Commission was created. In 1907, nature responded most beautifully and gave this country the most bountiful crop it had ever had. Other industries were busy too, and from a natural standpoint, all the conditions were right for a most prosperous year. Instead, a panic entailed enormous losses upon us. Wall Street knew the American people were demanding a remedy against the recurrence of such a ridiculously unnatural condition. Most senators and representatives fell into the Wall Street trap and passed the Aldrich Vreeland Emergency Currency Bill. But the real purpose was to get a monetary commission which would frame a proposition for amendments to our currency and banking laws which would suit the money trust. The interests are now busy everywhere educating the people in favor of the Aldrich Plan. It is reported that a large sum of money has been raised for this purpose. Wall Street speculation brought on the panic of 1907. The depositors' funds were loaned to gamblers and anybody the money trust wanted to favor. Then, when the depositors wanted their money, the banks did not have it. That made the panic." So this would be a sort of a Ron Paul of his day, Lindbergh Sr., warning you that, hey, they're going to say they're doing it in your name, provide stability, fight inflation, etc., but really, it's in the interest of the money trust, the oligarchs, or the central bankers, as we might call them today. We're on 12, and we're going up to 15. As I said, shortest chapter in the book. Edward Vreeland, V-R-E-E-L-A-N-D, co-author of the bill, Edward Vreeland, wrote in the August 25, 1910 Independent, which was owned by Aldrich, "Under the proposed monetary plan of Senator Aldrich, monopolies will disappear because they will not be able to make more than 4% interest, and monopolies cannot continue at such a low rate. Also, this will mark the disappearance of the government from the banking business." Vreeland's fantastic claims were typical of the propaganda flood unleashed to pass the Aldrich Plan. Monopolies would disappear, the government would disappear from the banking business, pie in the sky. Nation magazine, January 19, 1911, noted, "The name of the central bank is carefully avoided, but the Federal Reserve Association, the name given to the proposed central organization, is endowed with the usual powers and responsibilities of a European central bank. So even the Progressive magazine is saying the same thing. After the National Monetary Commission had returned from Europe, it held no official meetings for nearly 2 years. No records or minutes were ever presented showing who had authored the Aldrich Plan. Since they held no official meetings, the members of the commission could hardly claim the plan as their own. The sole tangible result of the commission's $300,000 expenditure was a library of 30 massive volumes on European banking. Typical of these works is a 1,000-page history of the Reichsbank, the central bank which controlled money and credit in Germany, and whose principal stockholders were the Rothschilds and Paul Warburg's banking family house of M.M. Warburg Company. The commission's records show that it never functioned as a deliberative body. Indeed, its only meeting was the secret conference held at Jekyll Island, and this conference is not mentioned in any publication of the commission. Senator Cummins passed a resolution in Congress ordering the commission to report on January 8, 1912, and show some constructive result of its 3 years' work. In the face of this challenge, the National Monetary Commission ceased to exist. With their $5 billion as a war chest, the Aldrich Plan propagandists waged a no-holds-barred war against their opposition. Andrew Frame testified before the House Banking and Currency Committee in 1913 as a member of the Executive Committee of the American Bankers Association. He represented a group of Western bankers who opposed the Aldrich Plan. Chairman Carter Glass: why didn't the Western bankers make themselves heard when the American Bankers Association gave its unqualified, and we are assured, unanimous approval of the scheme proposed by the National Monetary Commission? Andrew Frame: I'm glad you called my attention to that. When that monetary bill was given to the country, it was but a few days previous to the meeting of the American Bankers Association in New Orleans in 1911. There was not one banker in 100 who had read that bill. We had 12 addresses in favor of it. General Hamby of Austin, Texas, wrote a letter to the President, Watts, asking for a hearing against the bill. He did not get a very courteous answer. I refused to vote on it, and a great many other bankers did likewise. Mr. Bulkley, there's a transcript here. Do you mean that no member of the association could be heard in opposition to the bill? Andrew Frame: they throttled all argument. Mr. Kindred: but the report was given out that it was practically unanimous. Andrew Frame: the bill had already been prepared by Senator Aldrich and presented to the Executive Council of the American Bankers Association in May 1911. As a member of that council, I received a copy the day before they acted upon it. When the bill came in at New Orleans, the bankers of the United States had not read it. Mr. Kindred: did the presiding officer simply rule out those who wanted to discuss it negatively? Andrew Frame: they would not allow anyone on the program who was not in favor of the bill. Chairman Glass: what significance has the fact that at the next annual meeting of the American Bankers Association held at Detroit in 1912, the association did not reiterate its endorsement of the plan of the National Monetary Commission, known as the Aldrich Scheme? Andrew Frame: it did not reiterate the endorsement for the simple fact that the backers of the Aldrich Plan knew that the association would not endorse it. We were ready for them, but they did not bring it up. End of the transcript. Andrew Frame exposed the collusion which in 1911 procured an endorsement from the Aldrich Plan from the American Bankers Association, but which in 1912 did not even dare to repeat its endorsement for fear of an honest and open discussion of the merits of the plan. So anybody who thinks that suppression and cheating and dishonest tactics is anything new, it's not. It's the way democratic politics is normally conducted. Chairman Glass then called as witness one of the 10 most powerful bankers in the United States, George Blumenthal, partner of the International Banking House of Lazard Frere, and brother-in-law of Eugene Meyer. J.R. Carter Jr., Carter Glass, effusively welcomed Blumenthal, stating that, quote, "Senator O'Gorman of New York was kind enough to suggest your name to us." A year later, O'Gorman prevented a state Senate committee from asking his master, Paul Warburg, so O'Gorman represents Warburg, any embarrassing questions before approving his nomination As the first governor of the Federal Reserve Board, remember, Warburg is the guy who did all the technical details and drawing it up at Jekyll Island. George Blumenthal stated, "Since 1893, my firm of Lazard Freres has been foremost in importations and exportations of gold and has thereby come into contact with everybody who had anything to do with it." Congressman Taylor asked, "Have you a statement there as to the part you have had in the importation of gold into the United States?" Taylor asked this because the Panic of 1893 is known to economists as a classic example of a money panic caused by gold movements. "No," replied George Blumenthal, "I have nothing at all on that because it is not bearing on the question." A banker from Philadelphia, Leslie Shaw, dissented with other witnesses at these hearings, criticizing the much-vaunted, quote, decentralization of the system. He said, "Under the Aldrich Plan, the bankers are to have local associations and district associations, and when you have a local organization, the centered control is assured. Suppose we have a local association in Indianapolis. Can you not name the three men who will dominate that association? And then, can you not name the one man who will dominate the three? The same is true in Richmond and everywhere else. When you have hooked the banks together, they can have the biggest influence of anything in the country, with the exception of the newspapers." So there you go. The twin powers of control are media and money. If you have a group that is loyal to itself, and it can acquire the media and money control, then it can control a much larger group. That's how 2% of the population can control the other 98%. They know who they are, they know where they're going, they set an agenda, and because they're loyal to each other, they're able to achieve that. And the first thing they do is try to take over the media and take over the money. And that really is almost a meta message of the Learning College, at least as pertains to Jews, which is the part you can't get in other colleges, let's say. To promote the Democratic currency bill, Carter Glass made public the sorry record of the Republican efforts of Senator Aldrich's National Monetary Commission. His House report in 1913 said, "Senator McVeigh fixes the cost of the National Monetary Commission to May 12, 1911 at $207,130. They have since spent another $100,000 of the taxpayers' money, so $300,000 plus. The work was done at such cost cannot be ignored, but having examined the extensive literature published by the Commission, the Banking and Currency Committee finds little that bears upon the present state of the credit market of the United States. We object to the Aldrich Bill on the following points." About 5 points. Its entire lack of adequate government or public control of the banking mechanism it sets up, so it appoints its own, and basically it's Congress has nothing but a nominal oversight. Its tendency to throw voting control into the hands of the large banks of the system, so it's a money trust, as Lindbergh said. The extreme danger of inflation of currency inherent in the system, well, that's been borne out over 100 years. The value of the dollar has gone from 100% to 1%. The insincerity of the bond funding plan provided for by the measure, there being a barefaced pretense that the system was to cost the government nothing. And again, the U.S. is now trillions of dollars in debt, and it was basically debt-free when all this was started. The dangerous monopolistic aspects of the bill. It's all amounting to the same thing. You're giving control over these to a bunch of private Jews. They're not just banks. They're not just the largest banks. They're banks owned by Jews. They're part of a global network. They can now print bonds or create money out of thin air in the form of bonds that the government has to pay back. So the government is, you know, the people who pay taxes, the only portion of the community that pays taxes on the whole rather than sucks taxes out is white males. So we force white males to pay off the debts of the government, and the government uses that money to buy votes and to expand itself. And the Jew bankers take a large cut, and so they arrange to live parasitically off whites. That's what the Federal Reserve means. Jews living parasitically off the people who work and earn. That's what central banking means. Our committee at the outset of its work was met by a well-defined sentiment in favor of a central bank, which was the manifest outgrowth of the work that has been done by the National Monetary Commission. so they were never let a crisis go to waste. They used the panic of 1907 to set in motion the planning that would lead to the money trust, or the Federal Reserve, which is a central bank. Glass's denunciation of the Aldrich Bill as a central bank plan ignored the fact that his own Federal Reserve Act would fulfill all the functions of a central bank. Its stock would be owned by a private stockholders who could use the credit of the government for their own profit. It would have control of the nation's money and credit resources, and it would be a bank of issue which would finance the government by mobilizing credit in time of war. In The Rationale of Central Banking, Vera C. Smith, Committee for Monetary Research and Education, June 1981, writes, "The primary definition of a central bank is a banking system in which a single bank has either a complete or residuary monopoly in the note issue." They can print money. "A central bank is not a natural product of banking development. It is imposed from the outside or comes into being as a result of government favors." So there would be banks, but there wouldn't be a central bank unless someone sets it up. Thus, a central bank attains its commanding position from its government-granted monopoly of the note issue, the right only, you are given the monopoly right to print money. You understand how that is essentially granting you all power, because when you print money, you can then use that money, pass it out among your friends, and buy everything of note, and sink everybody else into the most abject poverty. Or you can do it degree by degree and slowly steal their nation from them. And that is what the Jews, bankers, have done to us. Also, as we go into the last few lines here, the act of establishing a central bank has a direct inflationary impact because of the fractional reserve system, which allows the creation of book entry loans and thereby money a number of times the actual money which the bank has in its deposits or reserves. So it's like they say you have to keep a tenth of what you have, but they just multiply it down the system. So there's 100 times, 10 times 10 times 10, but there's only 10 there. There's not 100,000 there when someone comes to claim it. So fractional reserve is inherently crooked. The Aldrich Plan never came to a vote in Congress because the Republicans lost control of the House in 1910 and subsequently lost the Senate and the presidency in 1912. So next we'll hear about the Federal Reserve Act in Chapter 3. Anyway, that's Chapter 2. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you for more from The Secrets of the Federal Reserve by Eustace Mullins real soon.